Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I noticed the first crack in our marriage on a Tuesday evening in March. The rain drummed against our meticulously restored Victorian windows. Windows I'd personally measured, ordered, and installed during the 3-year renovation that had once been our shared passion. Clara and I had purchased this house as a skeleton, a beautiful disaster with good bones and terrible wiring. Now it stood as a testament to my architectural vision and our supposed partnership. "I'll be home all day tomorrow," Clara said, not looking up from her phone as she tracked something with intense focus. "Just working on the Alexander wedding invitation, sweet." I nodded, watching her fingers move across the screen. My wife of 12 years ran a boutique graphic design studio specializing in luxury wedding invitations. Ironic, considering how little attention she now paid to our own marriage. Her home office occupied what was once meant to be a nursery, a fact neither of us acknowledged anymore. The Portland meeting might wrap early. "I could be back by dinner," I offered, searching her face for any flicker of interest. "Don't rush," she replied, finally setting her phone down. "Those clients are paying premium rates for your time. Give them the full David Matthews experience." That night, we followed our fertility treatment protocol. Clara checked her ovulation app, announced it was an optimal window, and we had intimacy without looking each other in the eye. 3 years of trying, dozens of doctor visits, countless hormone injections, all leading to these scheduled encounters that felt more clinical than intimate. The Portland meeting did end early. My client approved the designs with minimal revisions. I found myself driving home at 3:30 p.m., looking forward to surprising Clara with dinner reservations at the French bistro she used to love. Our driveway was empty. The house sat silent, no lights in Clara's office window where she claimed she'd be working all day. I sat in my car for 17 minutes, watching the afternoon shadows stretch across our perfectly maintained lawn. At 4:47 p.m., Clara's white Audi pulled into the driveway. She stepped out carrying two grocery bags, her hair slightly mussed, wearing the same outfit from this morning, the navy blouse and gray pencil skirt she typically changed out of the moment she started working from home. Her face when she saw my car can only be described as momentary panic, quickly rearranged into manufactured surprise. "David, you're home early," she said, approaching with grocery bags, creating a convenient barrier between us. "I just ran out for dinner ingredients. I was thinking we could try that new pasta recipe from the Times." That night, as we ate her hastily prepared pasta, Clara's phone buzzed 17 times. She never once checked it, though her eyes flicked toward it with each vibration. The Clara I'd married checked her phone obsessively, responding to client messages within seconds. This Clara, whoever she was becoming, had remarkable restraint when it suited her. I lay awake that night, cataloging inconsistencies in my mind, the way I would structural flaws in a building inspection. An architect is trained to notice when something is out of alignment, when a foundation shows signs of settling, when a roofline isn't quite true. My marriage was showing hairline cracks, and I couldn't ignore them anymore. Over the next 3 weeks, I began documenting the evidence methodically. My architectural training had taught me to analyze problems systematically, identify the issue, gather information, determine the cause, develop solutions. I created a private document on my work laptop, recording Clara's behavioral changes with clinical detachment. Client meetings always scheduled during my business trips. New lingerie appearing in her drawer. Black lace. Red silk. Items I hadn't purchased. Changed perfume from her signature floral to something muskier. More seductive, increasingly possessive about her phone obsessive about cleaning the guest room after my trips. The guest room cleaning pattern was particularly telling. Clara had never been fastidious about housework. Yet after each of my business trips, she insisted on personally deep cleaning the guest room, stripping the bed, washing everything on the sanitize cycle, vacuuming with meticulous attention to detail. "Let me help," I offered after returning from Chicago, finding her on her hands and knees scrubbing the guest bathroom floor. "Don't be silly," she said, not looking up. "You work too hard. This is meditative for me." Meditative. An interesting choice of words for someone who had previously described cleaning as soul-crushing drudgery, the confirmation I didn't want arrived. During our monthly fertility appointment, Dr. Reeves reviewed our file while I sat beside Clara, holding her hand as we'd done for 3 years. "I see you missed your last two monitoring appointments, Clara," Dr. Reeves said, glancing up with professional concern. "Consistency is important with hormone therapy." Clara's hand tightened in mine. "There must be some mistake." "I was here both times." Dr. Reeves frowned, checking her tablet again. "I don't show any record of your visits on February 18th or March 4th. I remembered those dates immediately. Both were days I'd been traveling for work. Days Clara had texted me about positive appointments, sharing fabricated details about hormone levels and follicle counts. Your office must have made a clerical error," Clara insisted, her voice rising. "I specifically remember the nurse commenting on my improved numbers. That night I checked our shared credit card statement online. Clara had made multiple charges at salons I'd never heard her mention, restaurants that weren't in our neighborhood, and most tellingly, hotel parking fees on days I was out of town. The next morning, Clara complained of a headache. While she was in the shower, I searched through her purse and found a receipt from La Perle Boutique dated during my Portland trip. $340 for lingerie, massage oils, and scented candles, items I'd never seen or experienced. That evening, Clara announced she needed to deep clean the guest room again. Why? I asked. I'm expecting a potential client to view my portfolio next week while you're in Seattle, she replied without missing a beat. As Clara slept beside me that night, I stared at the ceiling, my architect's mind piecing together a blueprint of betrayal. If she was cleaning that room so frantically after my trips, what or who was she trying to erase? 2 days before my scheduled Seattle trip, I told Clara I needed to finalize some blueprints in my home office. "Don't wait up," I said casually. "These structural revisions might take all night." Clara nodded absently, already absorbed in her phone. Once she'd retreated to our bedroom, I gathered my inspection tools, items I typically use to examine building materials and construction quality. The UV flashlight, designed to detect water damage and material flaws, would serve a different purpose tonight. I approached the guest room methodically, the way I'd inspect a potentially compromised structure. The space appeared immaculate, bed perfectly made with our expensive linen sheets, decorative pillows arranged with Clara's designer eye, surfaces dust-free and gleaming. But an architect's eye sees beyond surfaces. The hardwood floors, hand-selected oak I'd installed myself, showed faint scuff marks near the bed, marks that shouldn't exist given how rarely we used this room. The area rug had been recently shampooed. I could detect the faint chemical smell beneath Clara's signature room spray. Under the UV light, the pristine appearance crumbled further. A faint stain appeared on the mattress despite the freshly laundered bedding. On the floor, near where the baseboard met the carpet edge, I found it, a small torn corner of a condom wrapper, missed in Clara's otherwise thorough cleaning. I photographed everything with my phone, documenting each piece of evidence as I would document structural flaws for a client. My hands remained steady, my breathing controlled. I felt a strange detachment, as though I were evaluating someone else's. Collapsing marriage, the bedside table drawer, contained more evidence, a small bottle of massage oil from the same expensive brand listed on the receipt I'd found in Clara's purse. In the guest closet behind a stack of towels and cleaning supplies, I discovered a box of condoms, half empty. We hadn't used condoms since before our marriage. I spent the night in my office, not working on blueprints, but processing the reality of my life. My architect's mind automatically began problem solving. I needed more than circumstantial evidence for divorce proceedings. I needed documentation of the adultery and protection for my assets. The next morning, Clara was unusually affectionate, making my favorite breakfast and initiating a conversation about baby names, a subject that now felt like a grotesque manipulation. I was thinking, if we have a boy, we could name him after your father, she said, refilling my coffee cup. Robert is such a strong, classic name. That afternoon, I called my Seattle client and rescheduled our in-person meeting to a video conference, explaining that a personal matter required my attention. Then I researched discreet surveillance equipment online. My architectural projects sometimes required security monitoring during construction, so I was familiar with camera systems. I ordered a professional kit of wireless cameras designed for construction site security, small, battery-operated, and virtually invisible when properly positioned. I paid for overnight shipping using my personal credit card. The package arrived the next morning while Clara was at her Tuesday yoga class, the one commitment that hadn't varied in 5 years. I installed cameras throughout our house with the efficiency of someone who understood structural hiding places. One in the living room concealed within a bookshelf, another in the kitchen disguised as a USB charger, one in the hallway hidden in a smoke detector, and most importantly, two in the guest room, one angled toward the bed, another capturing the entire space. As I kissed Clara goodbye the next morning, my bag packed for a trip I wouldn't take, she whispered against my neck, I'll miss you. I wondered how many times she'd said those exact words while planning to betray me before I'd even reached the airport. I checked into the Marriott in Olympia at 11:30 a.m., exactly 1 hour from our home, close enough to return quickly if necessary, far enough to establish a solid alibi. The hotel room became my surveillance command center, laptop open to the monitoring app, phone notifications activated for motion detection. Clara's morning routine played out on my screen like a mundane reality show. She made coffee, answered emails at her desk, took a shower at 10:15. Nothing unusual until 2:47 p.m., when my phone buzzed with a motion alert. The front door camera captured Clara greeting a man I'd never seen before, tall, early 30s, wearing an expensive suit that spoke of financial district success. She kissed him immediately. Not the brief greeting of business associates, but the passionate embrace of lovers reunited. He carried an overnight bag and an expensive bottle of wine. Through multiple camera angles, I observed Clara giving her lover a tour of our home. She showed him my architecture awards displayed in the living room, laughing at what appeared to be jokes at my expense. In the kitchen, they opened the wine. I recognized the bottle immediately. It was from our wedding collection, gifted by Clara's parents, a $200 Bordeaux meant for our 15th anniversary. The guest room camera captured everything in high definition. Clara had prepared the space meticulously, fresh flowers on the nightstand, candles ready to be lit, the expensive massage oil prominently displayed. Their intimacy was natural, comfortable. This clearly wasn't their first encounter. Most devastating was their conversation, captured with perfect clarity by my hidden microphones. How's the baby-making charade going? The man, Nathan, she called him, asked as they lay in our guest bed drinking our anniversary wine. Clara laughed in response. God, it's exhausting. Another negative test. Another round of, we just need to keep trying. The fertility specialist is starting to suspect something's off since I keep skipping appointments. He still doesn't suspect anything? Nathan inquired. David? No, she replied dismissively. He's too focused on his blueprint revisions and client meetings. The man literally designs dream homes for other people while being completely oblivious that his own is falling apart. She reached for her purse beside the bed, extracting a small pill container labeled Daily Vitamins. From it, she removed a tiny pill and swallowed it with wine. Birth control hidden in a vitamin container, Nathan observed. That's cold, babe. It's practical, Clara corrected matter-of-factly. David wants a baby so badly he'd probably count my pills if I kept them in their original packaging. They discussed their arrangement with disturbing pragmatism. Nathan worked in finance, traveled frequently for business, and had a wife and two young children in the suburbs. Clara expressed relief that Nathan understood her desire for freedom without the burden of motherhood. Have you thought more about leaving him? Nathan asked. and deal with divorce attorneys, asset division, and explaining to my Catholic parents why their perfect daughter's marriage failed? No thanks, she replied with a laugh. This works for now. I have the security of marriage and the excitement of us. As night fell, they ordered expensive takeout using my credit card, ate dinner in my formal dining room, and returned to the guest room. The violation of my home, my trust, and my financial security crystallized my resolve for revenge. From my hotel room, I began planning. I researched divorce attorneys specializing in adultery cases and asset protection strategies. But traditional divorce proceedings felt inadequate for the scope of Clara's deception. I realized Clara's greatest vulnerability was her family's opinion. Her parents, Robert and Linda Martinez, were devoutly Catholic and impossibly traditional. They'd funded Clara's education and gifted us the down payment for our house as a wedding present. Her brother John, a county sheriff's deputy, and sister Sarah, a social worker, both maintained strict moral standards and had never hidden their disgust for infidelity. Clara's family believed she was the perfect daughter, successful in business, devoted to her marriage, working diligently toward providing the grandchildren they desperately wanted. Their opinion of her was the foundation of her self-image and social standing. As Nathan and Clara fell asleep in my guest room, I scrolled through my phone contacts until I found the Martinez family group. I stared at their names, calculating the most effective approach to destroy more than just my marriage. I returned home the following evening to find Clara cleaning frantically, the house filled with competing scents of bleach and vanilla candles. When she heard my key in the lock, she greeted me with manufactured enthusiasm, her hair still damp from a recent shower. "You're back," she exclaimed, kissing my cheek with exactly the right amount of pressure, not too passionate, not too distant. "How was Seattle?" "Productive," I replied, watching her performance with new awareness. Over the following days, I conducted reconnaissance on Clara's family with the same methodical approach I used for architectural surveys. The Martinez family operated like a close-knit unit with predictable patterns and behaviors. Robert Martinez, 67, was a retired electrician who volunteered at their church and had worked two jobs for 20 years to send Clara and her siblings to private schools. His protective streak regarding his daughters was legendary in the family. Linda Martinez, 64, had taught elementary school for 40 years and viewed family reputation as paramount in their tight-knit community. She coordinated the church charity committee and hosted monthly family dinners where attendance was mandatory. John Martinez, 35, worked patrol shifts for the county sheriff's department and had arrest authority in our jurisdiction. Sarah Martinez, 32, managed social services cases and had seen firsthand how infidelity destroyed families. Most importantly, I knew the Martinez family maintained an emergency phone tree. Clara had explained it years ago. If one family member was in crisis, everyone got notified simultaneously and dropped everything to help. The Martinez family's devotion to Clara was unquestionable. She was their success story, the talented daughter who'd married well, built a business from scratch, and maintained perfect family values. They'd invested financially and emotionally in our marriage, viewing me as the stable partner who complemented Clara's creative nature. I scheduled another business trip, this time to Vancouver for a three-day consultation with a luxury resort developer. I created a detailed itinerary, booked the hotel using our joint account so Clara could verify the reservation, and made sure she knew the exact dates. "I'll be gone Wednesday through Friday next week," I mentioned casually over breakfast. "The Vancouver client is considering major renovations to their mountain properties." Clara nodded, her attention divided between her phone and her coffee.
"That sounds fascinating," she replied absently.
"I'll probably use the time to catch up on some design projects." I watched her face carefully as she processed this information. A slight twitch at the corner of her mouth, anticipation perhaps. She was already planning her rendezvous. My preparation was meticulous. I installed additional cameras with better audio capabilities, ensuring multiple angles and clear sound quality. I backed up all existing footage to several secure cloud accounts and prepared a file of evidence for my attorney. Clara, meanwhile, seemed increasingly excited about my upcoming trip. She mentioned several times how she planned to deep clean the house and work on a major design project while I was away. Her anticipation was palpable, and I recognized it now as the excitement of someone planning a romantic getaway in her own home. The night before my supposed departure, Clara initiated intimacy for the first time in months. Not our scheduled fertility-focused encounter, but something that almost mimicked passion. I understood it now as her clearing her conscience, fulfilling her wifely duty before betraying our vows again. From my hotel room an hour away, I watched Clara prepare for Nathan's arrival with disturbing attention to detail. She changed the sheets on the guest bed, setting out fresh towels and arranging flowers purchased with our joint credit card. She showered, shaved, and applied expensive perfume before changing into black lingerie I'd never seen before. At 7:15 p.m., Nathan arrived carrying champagne and roses. Clara greeted him with passionate intimacy that confirmed their relationship extended far beyond physical attraction. They moved through our house with the comfortable familiarity of a couple who had done this many times before. I waited until 9:30 p.m., ensuring they were settled and vulnerable. The bedroom camera showed them drinking champagne, laughing intimately, and beginning to undress. This was the moment. They were committed, exposed, and unaware of the trap closing around them. With surgical precision, I initiated my plan. I sent a group text to Clara's parents, siblings, and their spouses. Emergency! Clara's been shot! I'm driving from Vancouver, but I'm hours away. Please get to the house immediately and call 911. She's in the guest bedroom. The response was immediate and chaotic. Robert called my phone within seconds, but I let it go to voicemail, maintaining my fiction of being unreachable while driving frantically from Canada. Linda sent a series of panicked texts asking for details. John immediately called his parents and sister, coordinating their emergency response while rushing to our house. At 9:47 p.m., the front door camera showed Robert's truck pulling into our driveway aggressively, followed immediately by Linda's sedan. They ran toward the house, Robert carrying what appeared to be a crowbar from his truck. The panic in their movements was genuine. They believed their daughter was dying. The guest room camera captured Clara and Nathan, naked and unaware, continuing their intimate encounter. The audio picked up their conversation about planning a weekend getaway, completely oblivious to the family members about to break down the front door. The collision happened at 9:51 p.m., Robert used his crowbar to force open the front door while Linda screamed Clara's name. Their panicked voices echoed through the house as they rushed toward the guest room, expecting to find their daughter bleeding and in need of medical attention. Instead, they burst through the door to discover Clara naked in bed with Nathan, both frozen in shock and horror. The initial seconds were captured in brutal detail, Linda's scream of confusion, Robert's face transforming from panic to rage, Clara's desperate attempt to cover herself while Nathan scrambled for his clothes. What the hell is this? Robert roared, his fear for his daughter's life instantly replaced by fury. Dad! Clara clutched the sheet to her chest. What are you doing here? Linda stood in the doorway, one hand covering her mouth, tears streaming down her face.
Clara Maria Martinez, she whispered,
using Clara's full name as she had whenever Clara was in serious trouble as a child.
What have you done?
John arrived 30 seconds later, his hand instinctively reaching for the service weapon he wasn't carrying. He assessed the situation immediately. No shooting victim, no medical emergency, just his sister caught in flagrant adultery. The confrontation escalated quickly. Robert began yelling about family values and the sanctity of marriage. Linda alternated between sobbing and berating Clara about the embarrassment she'd brought upon their name. Nathan attempted to leave, but John blocked his exit, demanding identification and threatening to call his on-duty colleagues. Sarah arrived with her husband Mike just as the situation reached its peak, adding more voices to the chaotic scene. The violence I'd anticipated began when Robert pushed Nathan against the wall while shouting about destroying his daughter's marriage. You son of a bitch, Robert yelled, grabbing Nathan by the shirt.
You've destroyed my daughter's marriage!
John grabbed Nathan by the collar and threatened him.
You're going to give me your full name and address right now, he demanded,
or I'm calling this in as a domestic disturbance. Clara attempted damage control through frantic explanations, but her family's trust had been shattered irreparably. The perfect daughter they had respected had been systematically lying, not just to her husband, but to them as well. "You've been pretending to try for a baby," Linda said, her voice breaking. "While we've been praying for grandchildren, you've been this." As police sirens became audible in the distance, likely called by concerned neighbors hearing the commotion, "I began my drive home to deliver the final blow to my meticulously planned revenge. I arrived home at 10:43 p.m. to find three police cruisers in my driveway, neighbors standing on their porches, and my house illuminated by flashing lights. I parked calmly and approached with manufactured concern, asking the officer at the perimeter what had happened to my wife. Inside, Clara sat on our living room couch wrapped in a bathrobe, her face streaked with tears and mascara. Her family stood around the room, Robert and Linda near the fireplace, John speaking with a senior officer, and Sarah comforting her mother while shooting disgusted glances at Clara. Nathan was gone, having been escorted out after providing his information. The guest room remained a crime scene of betrayal, with scattered clothing, overturned champagne glasses, and the lingerie Clara had worn for her lover now evidence of her deception. "Mr. Matthews," the senior officer approached me, "there seems to have been a misunderstanding. We received reports of a shooting at this address, but found a domestic situation. I played my role perfectly, expressing confusion while maintaining my fiction of being contacted in Vancouver. I showed my hotel receipt and rental car agreement that supported my alibi. The police accepted my story completely. I was the betrayed husband, the victim in this domestic drama." When the officers finally left, Clara's family remained, too emotionally invested to depart. "I approached Clara while her parents conferred in the kitchen. 'You planned this?' she whispered, her voice breaking. I showed her my phone with the camera app open, displaying the live feeds from our guest room. Clara's face transformed as she realized the scope of my planning, the surveillance system, the false emergency call, the coordinated family response. 'I discovered what you've been doing,' I said quietly. 'I simply ensured your family discovered it too.' 'How long have you known?' she asked desperately. 'Long enough to record everything,' I replied. 'The affair, the birth control pills, the lies about fertility treatments, every conversation where you mocked our marriage. I produced the divorce papers from my briefcase, already prepared and legally binding. You have 30 days to vacate our home. My attorney will contact you about asset division.'" Clara's breakdown was complete. She collapsed onto the couch, sobbing uncontrollably as the full implications hit her. She'd lost her marriage, her family's respect, her home, and her reputation in a single evening. Robert approached me before leaving, shaking my hand firmly. "I'm sorry, son," he said with genuine regret. "We had no idea," Linda hugged me tearfully. "We raised her better than this," she replied through her tears. "I don't know what happened to our Clara." John offered to provide police statements supporting my divorce case, while Sarah promised professional recommendations for therapists to help me process the betrayal. As her family left, I retrieved a suitcase from our bedroom closet and placed it beside Clara on the couch. "I suggest you pack what you need tonight," I said calmly. "I'm changing the locks tomorrow morning." 6 months later, I live in a modern downtown condominium I designed myself. Clean lines, minimal furniture, and floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking the city. The divorce finalized quickly, with Clara receiving minimal settlement and no spousal support. The judge was particularly unsympathetic after reviewing the video evidence of her discussing birth control while undergoing fertility treatments at my expense. I kept our house, though I no longer live there. I rent it to a young professional couple who appreciate its architectural details without knowing its history. The surveillance equipment remains installed, though I never mention it to my tenants. Clara's life disintegrated completely. Her family maintains minimal contact, treating her with polite distance during unavoidable gatherings. Her luxury wedding design business collapsed when clients learned about the scandal, her reputation for celebrating sacred unions shattered by her own infidelity. She works for a corporate design firm now, earning a fraction of her previous income. Nathan returned to his wife and children after his affair became public through Clara's family connections. His marriage survived through expensive counseling, but Clara lost both her lover and her husband in a single night. "I've found unexpected peace in my solitude. Without the constant stress of Clara's deceptions, I sleep better, focus more clearly on my work, and have begun dating a divorced colleague who appreciates my honesty. My architecture practice thrives as word spreads about my personal integrity. Clients trust me to build their dream homes because they know I value authentic foundations. Keep the camera recordings as insurance, but rarely watch them. The evidence served its purpose, exposing Clara's true character to the people whose opinions mattered most to her. My revenge was complete not because I destroyed Clara's life, but because I allowed her actions to destroy it naturally. Like any well-designed structure, it was built on solid foundations and designed to last." And that's the end of today's story. If you enjoyed it, please give this video a thumbs up and drop a comment below. Your support helps the algorithm push my content further. If you're new to the channel, don't forget to hit that subscribe button. It really helps me keep creating more stories for you. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you in the next one.